Today being Mother's Day, I think we'll start there and perhaps go into our scripture reading also, we'll see. When we think about the descent of this line of gurus into the world, you realize that masters come for a specific purpose. Sometimes people have talked to me about the necessity for a living guru earlier on. I would say earlier in the history of Ananda, when everything was more confused in the 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, when it just wasn't clear to anybody what the spiritual path was really going to be like in the West. And you read Autobiography of a Yogi, and it is so much about Yogananda's discipleship, relationship with Sri Yukteswar, and his quest for a guru, and everybody's relationship in that way. And the natural thought is, in fact, that's how many people would read Autobiography of a Yogi. After reading this, I'm going to go to India. And this Swami used to say, I'm going to stand on a street corner like this until somebody comes and touches me on the chest and gives me cosmic consciousness. Because that's the impression you get from the autobiography. And so you naturally, it's quite natural, to want to have someone with you who can correct you. A part of you also thinks it would be a little scary, but another part says that I would really like to have that. So you come into a situation such as the one that we're in, where all of the masters have already passed from this world, or even in the early years of Ananda. It's just the thought was, I need somebody who's there to talk to me. Well, naturally, it's a natural thought. But I reasoned it out at different times in very interesting ways. One was, well, the first and most obvious is, if that's what I really needed, God would give it to me. But the second is, when you have an avatar, a fully self-realized master, he only comes into the world, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Dad, I have this really loud sneeze. Once in a long meditation, my microphone was still on, and I interrupted about an hour and a half group meditation with the most ear-splitting, unbelievable sneeze, so I'm really paranoid about it now. But in any case, if you think about an avatar only takes a body. He's not compelled as we're compelled. The picture I always have in the astral world is we're there, everything is fine, but if you have desires that can only be fulfilled on a material plane, you have to come back into a material body to do it. Maybe certain specific relationships you wanted to act out, the desire to smoke or to drink. You can't do that in the astral world. Apple pie, pizza, you know, just various things like this. And so we're just hanging out in the astral world, but then a certain restlessness begins to set in. I mean, all of us experience it on this plane. We've had this. We're going to spend a quiet evening at home, but we feel a little restless. We're feeling really content with our lives, but then we feel a little lonely. We're really feeling positive about our careers, but then we feel a little anxious about something. Something takes our equanimity and disturbs it. And in the astral world, what happens, as I understand it, is your astral karma begins to run out, and various unfulfilled desires within you, or just unresolved issues. It's not only things that we want. I mean, regret and disappointment, a lack of fulfillment. It's all of it's there. And it makes us restless. And that restlessness puts us out of tune with the astral vibration, because we're beginning to vibrate on a frequency that can't happen there. And then before you know it, there you are in a womb. Pretty soon you're out of the womb and you're trying to figure out, where am I? How did I get here? And what am I supposed to do next? And then all the vrittis, all the karma in the spines begin to push us, and we're off and running one more time. And somewhere in here, it occurs to us that maybe there's another system. And that's when we begin to think not so much about the outer world, but the inner world. I was saying to a group yesterday, the single unifying demographic of people who come to Ananda is the realization that I must pay attention to the inner world, that the outer world isn't enough. And it's not really a question of what careers people follow, what geographic, economic strata they're in, social strata, whatever it is, that somewhere it has crossed our minds that I have to pay attention to the inner world. And the inner world is really the source of everything that I'm experiencing. And then how serious are we going to get about that? You know, do we want to just tweak it a little so that we can make the outer world work better? There's a lot of semi-spiritual things that are really just based on organizing your inner self so that you can conquer the outer world even better. But even that, after a time, it's a step in the right direction because at least we're pulling energy from the true source. But ultimately, we have to understand that really the inner world is the only reality, because whatever is going on out there, all we ever experience is our capacity to experience it. And then we also discover that our inner restlessness is causing all kinds of dissonance. You know, somebody says something that is more or less innocent or not intended as we hear it, and then all of a sudden there's something inside of us that responds to that. Well, I was going back from the point of view of the avatar. The avatar has no inner restlessness. He has no vrittis, he has no karma. There's nothing unresolved. Complete contentment in himself. And the only thing that ever draws that spirit into manifestation is us. Really us. Our restlessness. But now our restless desire to find peace, and the deep and profound longing we have to learn and to know. So the number of times that you or I have to take a physical body is quite a few more times than a true guru has to take a body. Very interesting in the readings of Edgar Cayce. I don't hear as much about Edgar Cayce now, but he was quite a remarkable savant, a seer. He would go into a trance state and then give these readings for people, and brought across a huge amount of fascinating information. And he would do life readings for people. And a surprising number of times he would say to someone, he was operated in the 40s and the 50s, and maybe into the 60s, I'm not quite sure, 1960s, I'm not sure when he died. But a surprising number of times someone would be sitting in front of him, and he would say to that person, "You were on the streets of Jerusalem and Jesus walked by. You were blessed by Jesus. You were there at a certain place when he was there. And everything that you have been doing since then has been to integrate that one experience." I mean, you think of 2,000 years of all the different lifetimes that you have, but all of it was the presence of the Master just turn something. And then for lifetimes and lifetimes after that, you're trying to figure out how to align yourself with that unique energy. There's a saying in India, one moment in the company of a saint will be your raft over the ocean of delusion. And that's a remarkable statement. That's the concept of darshan. Darshan is getting the light of a great master. So the masters come, especially this particular line of gurus who always seem to have some massive redirecting of the planet. That's what an avatar does. Many saints live, but an avatar comes always with some particular mission to take the whole of society and turn it in some way that's needed. He comes first for his disciples, but then through those disciples and through his presence to change in a massive way. Look at Christ, look at Buddha, look at Krishna, the ones that we know. Some are very lost in history, but still the influence goes on. So in our particular time and place, this particular line of gurus had a few very specific new directions to introduce. And because it's so early in the cycle, you know, Jesus was essentially obscure for almost 300 years after his passing. and no one who was just looking at life in a worldly way would have ever even imagined that that one rabbi crucified all those years before would still be reverenced and revered and remembered. Because the way that the force of these masters work, it's the same way they work within us, which is our transformation. True transformation is not quick because it's not superficial. It's very easy to wind yourself up tense enough to sort of turn yourself in a new direction, but to actually erase the karma, to actually erase the vrittis, to actually bring yourself to the point where it's not just a question of, I'm going to hold myself back from doing that, even though I want to get to the point where the thought doesn't even arise. I mean, that's what freedom really is when the thought doesn't even arise. It just doesn't occur to you to respond in an unkind way. It doesn't occur to you to carry a grudge. It doesn't occur to you to be afraid. And it's not, as I say, restraining it. It just doesn't come. And in order for the vritti to be really erased, it has to be replaced with a completely new perception. Just something completely different. In our Gita commentary today, that's what we're saying. It's not just a question of doing the right thing and making yourself look right. It's actually within yourself understanding what I'm doing and why. It's very interesting when I look back over the many years of Swami Kriyananda's teaching, how much of his teaching, I mean, he talked about meditation and he talked about Kriya, but what he mostly talked about was the right attitude to have toward life. And when he talked about master, he said that's what master mostly taught. Because if you have the right attitude toward life, you will gradually learn everything else. But if you don't have the right attitude toward life, even as Swami said, if you meditate many long hours every day, but your idea is getting power for yourself or making yourself strong or some harsh conquering attitude toward life without a corresponding expansion of sympathy and compassion and surrender to the power of God, you won't get what you think you're going to try to get. You will get a certain amount of power, but then it's going to just have to be undone later on. And so Master brought many different thoughts, but one of the most central to it is this very simple idea of God as Mother. And the worship of Divine Mother, he starts his autobiography just right from the very beginning. He talks about his devotion to Mother Kali and how to Divine Mother, and how he made images of Divine Mother and worshipped her. And he talks about his own human mother and what a profound and everlasting effect she had on him, and how bereft he was when his own mother died. And he himself, all through his life, he would always talk about God in that way. And in the West, where he came to give his message, you know, our image of God is Father. And there's a rebellion against that among female persons. But God the Father also exists because there are everything in creation is dual, and there is the wisdom aspect of the divine, and the masculine force is a powerful force and the feminine force. But from the point of view of the devotee, and this is what Master came to bring us. Master came to bring us an intimate relationship with God. That's why he called it self-realization. It's about myself and what I understand. This is why he brought Kriya Yoga, which is an entirely personal practice. Once you learn Kriya Yoga, you have to learn it from someone who is qualified to teach it, and so it's not just passed out on the sidewalk. You have to qualify, but it's easy to qualify. But once you qualify, it's your practice. And it's your private experience. There's no necessary ritual. There's no priest. My friend in India one of the early friends I had when we first started going, who was our tour guide for the groups we would take over, he bought an apartment, and then he couldn't move into it for 5 months because the priest determined the auspicious day was 5 months after the apartment was finished. And then all the necessary rituals had to be done before he could move in, which included lighting a fire in the living room and breaking coconuts against the wall, which required that the inside had to be refinished after all the ceremonies. I mean, just this whole thing. And he remarked about it afterwards. He said, Hinduism is the only religion we have to pay someone else to practice for us. Because it's a profession for the priest. He had to hire the priest. They had to come in and do it. He had to pay them to do it. I mean, this is his own spiritual practice, but he had to hire somebody to do it for him. He didn't even know what the rituals meant, you know, in the language, the Sanskrit that was used. But it's a funny way when you think about it, because how could our relationship with God be dependent on someone else's training? So this is what Master brought. He brought this entirely new way of doing it. Here is Kriya Yoga. Kriya Yoga is practiced in the spine, and Kriya Yoga gradually erases the vrittis. And what happens when you erase the vrittis is that our entire perception of reality begins to shift. And we begin to see ourselves, the world around us, everyone in it, everything we do, from a completely different and a more true perspective. We see ourselves as part of all that is. And nobody can do that for you, and nobody can take that away from you when you have it. A couple of weeks ago, I was speaking here of our friend Jai Ram, who's been incarcerated for 30 years in prison. And because of the intensity of his desire, he has attracted to him Kriya initiation in prison. Personally, Kriyacharya is coming in on two different occasions and giving him Kriya and then giving him higher initiations. And in the midst of the most chaotic, uncongenial circumstances you can imagine, no one can take away from him his relationship to God. So that's the first part of what Master brought us, which is he put spiritual responsibility in the place, the only place it can ever actually exist, which is in our own hands. No one can make us love God. We have to decide whether we're going to love him. And no one can save us from our own delusions unless we ourselves want to be saved. But the other side of that is, to whom are we relating? And how much courage do we have in that? You know, what does God mean? God is an exceedingly unfortunate word in English because it has absolutely no specific meaning. And many, many people who are atheist or agnostic are so with very, very good reason, because the only explanation of God that's ever been given to them is so profoundly unattractive or so illogical or so just, you know, narrow, no thinking person would want it. But that doesn't mean that that's what God is. That just means how people define it. The word that Swamiji used, Master used, is Satchidananda. The obstacle with that is it's a language that most of us don't know. Sanskrit, it means ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-newly experienced joy. Now, think about that from the point of view of what do I want in my life? I don't want to be snuffed out. We have this terrible fear of it all being taken away from us, don't we? Just becoming nothing. I remember a young friend of mine, when he was a child, he just had this terrible fear of dying. And his parents would try to tell him, you know, you're 6 years old, you're not going to die soon. Yes, but I will. And he, you know, very metaphysical way of thinking, because he felt he didn't want to be obliterated. That's how he understood it, ever existing. And then what's the good of existing if we're not aware of our existence? And what's the good of being aware of our existence if it's miserable? Ever existing, ever aware, ever conscious, ever new joy. Now, that's something. Who could not desire that? We might not believe it's possible, but certainly it's something worth aspiring to, isn't it? But then we still have our human hearts. And the trouble with our human hearts is they're so corrupted by those nasty little vrittis. And those nasty little vrittis just have all these misunderstandings of how I was hurt and what I have to be happy and all the things that were done to me and why don't people treat me differently and just and my back hurts and my kidney has cancer and just all these awful things that happen to us. So what we need, if we're going to really turn with courage, is we have to understand God in some way. And Jesus used the perfect word. Jesus said, after I'm gone, I will send you the Comforter. I just love that. I don't know what the original word is and what language. Doesn't matter. Just think of it. Every moment when you have felt restless or dismayed in any way, what is it that we seek? We seek to be comforted, don't we? I mean, that's why we go out and go to the movies and go buy a pizza and go look for our friends. We want someone to comfort us. You think about little babies and that just raising their hands and the way the mother holds the child and how the child can relax into that. Somebody told me yesterday so sweetly that they brought a little child to the temple here one Sunday, about a five-year-old, and the child was blessed, as we do in the Festival of Light, and then afterwards, the child was sobbing, and her friend was holding the little boy. What's wrong? But he was sobbing because he said, I felt all the love my mother has for me and so much more. He said, I just didn't know what to do with it. And he began to cry. But isn't that what it is? All the love my mother has for me. Whether you had that kind of mother or not, we all know what that is because this is what the heart is longing for, that comfort. So what Master brought to us is he talked to us about God as our mother. So that, and he says that there's a tape with his voice on it. Worship God as mother, he says, because mother is so much closer than the father, he says like that. Closer than the father. Because mother is so much closer than the father. When we think our human life is just a little imitation, it's just given us there so that we'll get a shadow form of what reality really is. But even in shadow form, think of the comfort of the mother. There's a picture of Swami Kriyananda. It's one of my favorites. He had a particularly close connection to his mother, Gertrude Walters. And she was a very dignified, very refined lady. And there's a picture of her, and she's sitting, it was in Romania where he grew up, and she's dressed as she was of a woman of her era, you know, in somewhat formal. And he's about 4 years old, and just lounging across her lap like this. And he's always had the same face. So there's this little tiny person with the same Kriyananda face on it. But just the whole attitude you can see of just absolute trust and absolute comfort. You know, he was right where he wanted to be. And she also was just completely at ease. I think she has her hand on his shoulder or something like that. And that's what we need to work with in our own hearts. In the privacy of our own meditations, which is the only place that we can really experience God. You come here to remind you, to renew your enthusiasm, to give you something else to contemplate. But in the end, it doesn't happen in this room. It happens in our hearts. And above all, what we must learn is to be absolutely unafraid of God. And absolutely confident without a shred of doubt that if we turn toward God, we will always be comforted. And any part of you that thinks differently is one of those nasty little vrittis trying to keep you away from where you really belong. And this was Master's message. Look within yourself. And when you look within yourself, what you will find is the mother. Mother's love is always selfless. And then this also tells us, who should I be? Who should I be? How should I serve others? What is my role? What instrument do I want to play in this world? It's not that the mother never asks anything of you. But at the same time she asks it of you, she reaches out her hand and lifts you up to make it possible. Isn't that so? You know, there's a tremendous force in this planet right now pushing toward the feminine. You know, feminine congressmen, lawyers, doctors, all these professions, the ministry is just littered with females, you know. Used to be a male profession, not at all. Well, many professions that used to be male are all turning over to women. And I think, as Swami said, so obviously men and women are just two sides of the same coin. You can't say that one side of the coin is worth more than the other side. But what's being said is, we're longing for the mother. We're not longing for super masculinized, aggressive, hard-edged people in female bodies who are less pleasant than the men they've replaced. That's not what we're looking for. But what we're longing for is the mother. Find that in your own heart. Then be that to the world. That's what God is asking of us now. And happy Mother's Day. God bless you.